This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Living dialogues means a conversation. A conversation gives birth to something that maybe neither Duncan nor myself nor any of us, when we're in conversation in this way, would have expected to happen. Living dialogues is very much about giving birth to insight, to connection, to connectedness, and to gratitude in the experience of those.
It's true. It becomes a dialogue that expands like a pebble in a pond. From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a Daya flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. And with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have as my guest, Richard Moss, MD, internationally respected teacher, visionary thinker, and author of 5 seminal books on transformation, self-healing, and the importance of living consciously. The most recent of which is The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness, which has won already wide praise from people such as Marianne Williamson, author of A Return to Love and The Gift of Change, who said of the book, "Richard Moss is one of the most important teachers of transformational knowledge." Deepak Chopra has said, "In this very elegant book, The Mandala of Being, Dr. Richard Moss offers practical suggestions and techniques to find that presence within you that allows you to know yourself as a limitless awareness. I have admired Dr. Moss's work for many years and highly recommend The Mandala of Being." This from other people that have been featured here on Living Dialogues, and we might go on to say that in his work, Richard has for 30 years guided people from diverse backgrounds and disciplines in the use of the power of awareness to realize their intrinsic wholeness and to reclaim the wisdom of their true selves. He teaches a practical philosophy of consciousness that models how to integrate spiritual practice and psychological self-inquiry into a concrete and fundamental transformation of people's lives. He lives in Ojai, California, with his wife Ariel. You can contact him at www.richardmoss.com. So, Richard, what a real delight to have you here on Living Dialogues.
Thank you, Duncan.
As I mentioned, we've had Marianne Williamson here as a frequent guest, and the same with Deepak Chopra, and it's a real pleasure to have this opportunity to do dialogues together, and particularly this wonderful new book of yours, The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness. It really fits in the mission, we might say, which has evolved here on Living Dialogues to, in a sense, connect people to the various gifts that are being given by people around the world to the evolution of a new planetary consciousness. And in particular, this gifting is characterized, I believe, at the highest levels by a transmission and sharing that does not make people dependent on a teacher or even on a particular community of inquiry where you are taught, you might say, and respect the teachings of how to be self-empowered, how to reach this state of, we might say, evolutionary awareness, or to be in the now, as Eckhart Tolle famously put it, and as you put it, without being dependent, as we say, on a teacher or on even a community of fellow practitioners. And from that point of view, you can collaborate either as a teacher or student or member of a community at, I believe, an even more amplified level. And so with that kind of hint of what is in The Mandala of Being, I thought we might begin, before we talk about the book itself, with your own evolution, and maybe start with a story that might come to your mind spontaneously from your early life or perhaps even childhood that foreshadowed your life work these last 30 years.
Ooh, well, first, I'm I'm honored to be in lovely company, the people that you mentioned, and I'm sure many, many others. I don't really think much about my past, and it
mm-hmm.
I certainly did years of work, psychological work and self-inquiry work in my 20s and 30s and on and off when I've wanted to through the years, to examine my own issues, the stuff I carry from my family and upbringing, and I don't think it always comes from there, but some of it, you know, just to work on the stuff of life. In terms of anecdotes or stories, you know, I think my life isn't very exceptional. I mean, I went to school at a time when I think the country invested more in education than it does now. Right after World War II, when the GIs came home, there was a real baby boomer. I'm in the front end of that generation. I remember when I went to school, Candace Pert was one of my classmates, and we were good friends.
Oh yeah, she's been
work on neurotransmitters and the biology of she's written about
the molecules
of emotion.
Exactly. Yeah, she's been a guest here with that book, and a lovely woman, really a terrific person.
Oh, she's a character.
Very
one of these minds that leaps everywhere and is interested in everything. Big heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I just think life was the 60s was an interesting time. It was so-called counterculture time. It was a mixture of self-exploration and politics and you know, social consciousness and all that. All of those things influenced me. But there's nothing all that specific or special about my life, I would say. That wouldn't be just sort of. I think I'd rather let the rest of the conversation stand for itself. Oh, I will say that about 20 something years ago, I met my current wife. I was married once before, and she joined me with three stepchildren for me, and that's been quite a journey to step from being a contemplative for many years. I started doing the work on. Consciousness work that I've been doing, which is very experiential based work with a lot of retreat with people, started doing that in the very late 70s. My wife and I met in 86 and started being together in 87 and married in 89. And I suddenly was with three children, and that was very powerful for me, very important in my life because you're not a teacher in your house. In your house, you're a husband, a father, a friend, and an asshole at times, and it's a wonderful, you know, then you put that side by side with where your ego isn't being stroked, with how easily it is to get your ego stroked when you are a guide or a leader, and in that balance, I think that's been incredibly healthy for me, and I really do think that ultimately the work on the couple is the work of the future for our world, when we can start making a better communication between male and female, masculine and feminine, man and woman, we will understand ourselves better and in ways that are both, let's say, transcendent and landed, right on the ground. And when we put those two together as a species, and they're very far from together now, though we're making great strides, then I think we'll see some profound changes in the world, and we are seeing them. So I would say, for me, the dance of my individuality and my capacity to be in relationship, of leadership and learning, of being a disciple and being a teacher, a disciple of life and of my own foibles and flaws, has been really the cycle of my journey.
And wonderful teaching material and sharing material as well. When you do manifest as a teacher, or in this case as an author, sharing your life experience. And I have to say, I'm so delighted to hear these brief stories and a sense of evolutionary history and progression there, because it's very similar to our work here on Living Dialogues, where I've talked for years now about the evolution of the human species altogether, as we might say, in parallel to the kind of experience we all know in human development from the infancy stage, as your most recent addition to your family, your new grandson, you know, and then moving from that through childhood, and that childhood stage then giving birth by necessity to an adolescent individuating stage, which moves away from that sense of being embedded in an alive universe. First the womb and then the protected space of hopefully a good childhood. But then just as the embryo has to move from the womb into separation and individuation for the complexity to take place and evolution to transpire, we move into adolescence where the emphasis is very much on individuation and individual empowerment over and against, we might say, Mother Nature and the natural world, sort of pushing that away to give ourselves an empowered identity. But then we found ourselves on the horns of a dilemma where the identity of individuation becomes its own trap, as you have so excellently observed in many subtle ways in your book. And we do then have to, in a sense, integrate within us the unity principle and the individuation principle and bring those together so we can then be prepared to enter into a relationship of real sacred marriage of Shiva Shakti, masculine principle, feminine principle, with all of creation, including individuals that we might mate with and literally bring forth or nurture, you know, a new womb, a new family, and so on. And so very much attuned to what you've just said and how that's elaborated in your book. And so I just realized by asking you to talk about your past, it's really, in a sense, ironic and amusing because it does illustrate how we can both honor our past and at the same time not get stuck in it. And at one point, when you talk about the mandala, you say that basically if we stand in the center of a circle like a mandala and we're considering that to be present in the now, the only way our mind can go away from the now is in one of four directions. We can go into the future, we can go into thoughts about the past, we can go into self-absorption thoughts, or we can go into obsessing about the external world or the other and tell ourselves stories that manage to keep us out of the center of the circle. And I like very much how you say that when we go into the past, we oftentimes find ourselves telling ourselves stories of regret or nostalgia, guilt. If we go into the future, our body itself experiences worry or hope and so on. So with that faint adumbration there, foreshadowing, why don't we ask you to tell us how you came up with this very powerful archetypal application, I should say, of this timeless archetypal model of the mandala.
Well, one of the pieces that I chose purposely not to talk about from my past was when I was 30, I had a deep, profound experience, a mystical experience, which is very difficult to talk about, and I've written about it. But it changed the referent for my life from knowing myself through my thoughts to knowing myself through consciousness or through being, through then being able to look at my identity as primordial thought, the thing that a baby doesn't have, which is a sense of me, which by the age of 5 or 6 becomes really consolidated as an identity, a basic identity of me. When we have the experience of transcending that for a while, of being able to look at that me, of seeing that me become just a point of awareness that's observing an experience of an entirely different and profound consciousness, a kind of knowing that has that we never really knew until you have the experience, though it's at the root of all religions, it's at the root of all deep wisdom, I believe. It's at the root of all great artists, I think, this some degree of this kind of experience. And so for myself, from that point on, my worldview started from the present, and I understood how people construct identity, and I began to understand, of course, how I did that in myself, in ways that were more than psychological. So for a long, long time, I was able to speak about, I mean, for 30 years of working with people in long retreats, the key to the retreats, the key to the healing I saw in my work, and as a physician, it fascinated me to see how many people would heal themselves of serious disease during these retreats. Whereas you could go through a whole career as a doctor and never see one true spontaneous remission, I saw many and wrote about them in my other books, in The Eye That Is We and in The Black Butterfly and in How Shall I Live, which are some of my previous books. I realized that the key to all the work was simply coming into the present moment, deeper and deeper into the now of ourselves. And that when we don't do that, the reason we don't do that is that the mind is not design, the egoic mind, the mind that becomes me at the age of 5 or 6, the identity with one's body, with one's feelings, with one's thoughts, one's sensations, and with the idea of who we will become in the future, and the idea of who we were in the past, and how we want to change or not change, how we want to repeat experiences that were good or avoid repeating experiences that we call bad, how the psychology of time would weaken our ability to really come into the immediacy of ourselves. And the psychology of time, as you mentioned, the past, with the beliefs that lead to a feeling of regret or nostalgia or blame or loss, and the psychology of the future, which causes us to oscillate back and forth between thoughts that are either hopeful or thoughts that are anxious-making or anxiety-provoking or fear-creating. And for the longest time, I understood that. And at the same time, parallel to it, I was talking about the nature of subject-object consciousness, because you can talk about subject-object consciousness only to the degree that you've transcended subject-object consciousness. Now, any athlete or people that are in an athletic state of flow briefly, to a certain extent, transcend layers or levels of the sense of subject and object. So the surfer and the surfboard and the wave become one, and the skier and the snow and the slope become one, and the poet in the moment that the words are flowing become one, and the artist similarly, and sometimes dancers. I remember watching Torval and Dean in the, this is a long time ago, mm-hmm. I think 72 or 74, no, maybe 82 or 84 Olympics. I guess it was 84
Olympics.
Well,
I think it would have been
winning the gold in the ice dancing.
82, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And watching them and thinking, it was palpable to me. I could see it, mm-hmm. a level of connection between the two. They forgot themselves. They were just the perfection of that performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and watching Michael Jordan play basketball and seeing this happening in so many people's lives, realizing that that's why we like to go running and reach that point where it does us, and that's why we like to sing or play until somehow we're being lived by something deeper. And in my work, I just emphasize this experience of entering deeply into so many different things until it lives you deeply. And at the other side of these experiences, where briefly the inner and the outer are the same thing, and the notion of me disappears into the flow of being, then on the other side of that, there was new wisdom, deep, profound insight, a whole kind of inner knowledge that would awaken inside of people that they could begin to tap, a whole spontaneous excitation of creativity and new vision, new purpose for their lives, and physical healing. And so I saw that it was really coming into the present, but it wasn't until about 7 or 8 years ago where suddenly I realized that the notion of the subject and object, or subject-object consciousness, and time really could be superimposed on each other, and that these things, this suddenly gave birth to this map to profound insight that's so archetypal that it's just going everywhere now through people who are working with people. But the nature of a mandala is its circle. So the people who are listening can visualize a circle. It's strongly oriented toward the center.
And let me just interject here. As I recall, the way this teaching first emerged was you were saying, and we'll come right back to the mandala here, you were saying that in your own experience when you were teaching or when you were in your workshops, you had that, well, let's call it the Michael Jordan or the Torval and Dean experience, and as did people in the workshop. You know, we found ourselves, you found yourself in that sense in the experience of unity, and you were in the zone, we might call it.
Well, it's a very easy thing to bring people to a profound,
yes,
centeredness and altered state temporarily.
That's
it's
the point.
It's not an easy thing for people to go home and be able to know how to continue to find that place or build their lives around a practice which brings them back again and again into the present. And that's why the mandala became so important, because people would change in the work with me profoundly, and then they would be back to the same patterns later on very easily, very quickly. And the same thing was true for me. I would be in such an expansive and liberated state of consciousness when I was working, as I had been in the initial experience that awakened or opened me. But when I went home as a stepdad and as a husband and found myself defensive or petty or resenting criticism or thinking that I was too important to be doing some of the things that needed to be done around the house and so forth, in the daily friction of life, I started to ask myself, what do I do different when I'm working? What do I do different when I'm really presented myself as a rock climber, which was and in mountaineering, which were things I did in my 20s and 30s and even into my 40s and 50s when I had time. What am I doing different there than I'm doing now when I'm being reactive, when I'm being angry, when I'm being defensive, when I'm being self-important? And it became really clear my mind was going into these four different directions that you mentioned before, into the past, the future, into a belief in my own specialness as a grandiose kind of specialness or a mm-hmm. depressive kind of specialness. Either I was superior or inferior, mm-hmm. better than others or less than others. So, you know, this oscillation of this and the kinds of beliefs I was telling myself and that I see people doing all the time that make them special in an inflated way or special in a depressive, deflated way. And then constantly all these stories about other people that create the most basic of feelings are anger and hurt. Either we're angry at people and we're attacking them, or we're hurt because they're bigger than us and they've done something to us, and we're envious and we're jealous with our thoughts, and we're
disappointed or feel betrayed,
impatient, and so forth.
Yeah.
And all of these emotions depend upon where the mind goes and how it leaves the now. And so the mandala is a picture of that.
And one of the ways I thought was very graphic that you described it was in attempting to give a visual depiction of this to people that are visually oriented. You said, well, now imagine, you know, I'm standing here in the center of a circle and I'm in the now. And what I found from my own self-inquiry is that if I leave that sense of unity and presence and aliveness, I go in one of four directions. And you say, I can walk this way and this could be the future, and that way could symbolize the past, and over here to the left could be,
yes,
you know,
exactly how it
subject.
Happened. I was just
yes,
walking
exactly.
around a carpet
yeah.
with a mandala, a carpet I'd brought back from Nepal in 1982 that had taken a family of four Tibetans a year to weave.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this in the center of my seminar space where I do my retreats, or if I can travel with it, I've brought it to places. I set it there. I love this carpet. I've stared at it for thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of hours. And I was walking around and saying, look, here, this 12 o'clock, that's the future. Over here, it's 6 o'clock, if this was a clock, that's the past.
Mm-hmm.
Over here at 3 o'clock, those are all the stories we have about others, about in the subject-object dichotomy. And over here at 9 o'clock, these are all the stories about ourselves. But the center of this mandala isn't me. It isn't me. It isn't me with my wounds, me with my hopes, me with my visions, me with my greatness, or me. It's none of it. The center is awareness. The center is a nameless awareness. It's not the awareness of the ego. It's a much deeper kind of awareness. And we can call it now, but the difference is the difference between a very superficial now where the mind is agitated or the mind is really dull and we need lots of stimulation from outside, with, you know, maybe intense music or intense emotions or intense arguments, or the mind is still and the senses are vivid, the colors are bright, and the sense of meaning isn't derived by the content of thought, but by simply being alive, simply feeling yourself breathing and observing the world around you, wherever you are. It's as if meaning floods you from within, and the purpose of life is obvious. That's a deep now. That's not superficial now, but the ego lives in a very superficial now and a very defensive one.
And here's where I'd really like to focus in on the power and the function of story and narrative, because one of the ways you continually describe this moving away from the now into the future or the past, which we might say could be the temporal dimension on a cross, and then the horizontal dimension would be, as you say, moving to either 9 o'clock or 3 o'clock, you move to the me-ness, the subjective, or you move to the objective, and you tell stories from those perspectives to essentially keep yourself out of the uncomfortableness and the uncertainty of the now, because if you're totally in the now, what emerges out of the now is a narrative that you don't know yet. And it could, if you're a person who is in fear and in control mode, be very threatening. And so by going into the future or into the subjective or into the past or into the objective perspective, you find strategies of ego survival and control. So the uncertainty of what may emerge, instead of being the adventure of the now and a gift that you're looking forward to, is something that you prevent yourself from getting into. And here what I'm thinking of is Lauren Vanderpost saying at one point that the person and their psyche is as dependent upon his or her story as the person's body is dependent upon food. And in the conventional sense, it's being seen as whatever persona, to use the Greek term, you're presenting yourself. You know, persona means mask, and in the ancient Greek theater, the mask would be put over a character to, this is an identity of a tragic character or a comic character or whatever. You would assume that identity for the purpose of the play. And here we do that in life, but behind the mask, behind the persona, is the deep essence of who you are. And if you're seen for that, as you say, this is the greatest act of compassion that one person can give to another. But it has to start with you being willing to see who you really are and actually enter into the unfolding soul story of the now rather than into these fabricated partial stories of the past or future.
But we start from those false stories or partial stories.
Exactly.
And what we need to understand, and that's why the beauty of the mandala, is that the center isn't the notion of me. The center of our lives aren't who we imagine ourselves to be, positive or negative. The center of our lives are not who we are trying to become, whether or trying hopefully not to become. The center of our lives isn't the loved one, our children, our spouse. It's not someone outside or something outside. And it's certainly our lives didn't begin in the past. So in my work, I say the most important concept that you need until you don't need concepts at all is that who we are begins right now. Who you are starts in this moment, and it is the awareness of the story about yourself that starts to wake you up. It's the awareness of the story about someone else that starts to wake you up, or the belief or the judgment about someone else. It's the awareness that these are ideas or thoughts about the future. They're not the real future, because that's unknowable. That's just imaginary, hypothetical. And it is not, you do not begin when you were born. Your physical body began then, but consciousness didn't begin then. Consciousness, you can see it everywhere on this planet, you know, and over time we're going to see it more and more out there in the whole of the universe. Consciousness isn't something that we have that starts with our bodies, and it's not limited just to our brain, though that is still an ongoing argument between different elements of science. But this deeper awareness that the Kabbalists would call the holy soul is something that is a present moment experience. And once we awaken to that, then we are on the evolutionary path. Now we have really started to outgrow the human as an idea of itself, the human man or woman as an idea of himself or herself. And we've come to something. That's why I love the Gnostic teaching, the Gospel According to Thomas, where Jesus says, I'll make a man so he's not a man, and a woman so she's not a woman, and they shall become as a single one. Well, of course, in our world, and I said at the beginning of this, the conversation, the dialogue, the process between man and woman is crucial. But if we start from conditioned identities and stories about what it means to be a man or to be a woman, we're going to just be in a ceaseless kind of negotiation and conflict. If we start from a deeper awareness, and the deeper consciousness isn't male or female, and it isn't born or doesn't die, and whether you've had that experience directly or not, or you just take on faith in a certain sense, or take on trust, that I can use my own deeper awareness to start to recognize my stories about myself. I can do this as a practice. I say this mandala is a compass. You know, you just look at it and it says, oh, I'm in the future now. That's why I'm going back and forth between fear and hope. Or it shows you, oh, I'm in the past now. That's why I'm going back and forth between blame and guilt and regret and nostalgia. Or, oh, I'm in a story about myself, which is why now I'm pumping myself in a special way that's making myself special in a grandiose way. Or now I'm telling myself stories about myself that's making me special as a victim or in a depressive or deflated way. And so forth. You look at this compass moment by moment and you say, who I really am starts right now. I am not the product of the story about the past. I am not the man who's making himself frightened because of the things he's thinking about the future. I'm not living to get to my life. I'm going to start my life right now. What am I feeling? What am I seeing? What is it? What is the meaning of life that's arising in me now that is the soul voice, truly the voice of the soul? And the voice of the soul does not speak to us conceptually very much. It speaks to us in a way of knowing that is sensual, kinesthetic, vibrant, perceptual, and then we translate that into a conceptual knowing.
Exactly. And as we suddenly come to the now of the end of this dialogue, quite imminent, I just wanted to quote from your book what implications this kind of deep self-inquiry has, not only to one's own self-transcendence, but to our experience of being with others in the world. And you say, and I'm quoting, "What is needed now, what evolution itself is demanding, is that we experience the self-transcending power of the soul. We do not have to change the world. We need only reclaim the fullness of our beings that is ever-present and always seeking to awaken in us. And in so doing, we become transmitters of a profound faith in life, and then the world begins to change." End of quote. And so I think that's a really wonderful way to summarize and end this particular initial dialogue, because we will, in a subsequent dialogue, go into, we might say, certain case studies or examples of how this method has evolved in your work and how it can be applied very specifically to certain situations, in fact, to all situations in our life.
Whatever work we do, it should be very practical. If we're going to have an understanding, that understanding should be able to translate into choice and new behavior and a new place to rest inside ourselves.
And I think for all that you've brought forth, I want to really honor your life work in this, Richard, and say this new book of yours really, I believe, does not only summarize your prior work, but it also brings, I think, a fresh perspective that is very easily accessible, this sense of a mandala of being. And as you say, it's already been taken up in certain business context where people see right away that the nature of relationship is what they're always struggling with when people are working together in a business context. And this gives another perspective that they found extremely useful. And so for those in our audience, we want to just honor you as well for your deep listening that has, in a sense, evoked exactly what's come through in this living dialogue. And to you personally, Richard, I just want to say it's been really stimulating and a great pleasure to spend this time together.
Thank you. Thank you, Duncan. That was excellent.
And for those of you that want to pursue this further, you can also go to richardmoss.com, where you will find a free course in how to apply the various methods described in this very excellent new book, The Mandala of Being. That's richardmoss.com. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. I've been with Richard Moss, author of The Mandala of Being, Discovering the Power of Awareness. Be with us again on Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, that's living, DialogueS.com. You can contact me at duncan@personallifemedia.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.